So whether they're Protestant or Catholic or Eastern Orthodox or whatever they are, Judaism is the foundation that we're going back to try to determine what worked the best when God was close to the people.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Tom Sarouf. And today I'm joined by Don Westblade, who I understand it is a professor at Hillsdale College. But you know, Don and I have just met for the first time, and I'm delighted that you're joining us. But I don't know anything about you, and I don't know what our listeners know. So how about you start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your professional, your personal background, your sort of academic interests, things of that sort.
Sure. Yeah, I've been teaching here at Hillsdale College for, I'm in my 36th year now, so been here quite a long time. Sometimes it seems like yesterday, sometimes it seems like a long time, but I've had a lot of good students come through here. I really enjoy interacting with students in the classroom. I learn a lot from the students, looking forward to this summer of learning from students in the honors program at ISI. I've got a wife and three kids. Three kids are all grown and scattered around the country. One came home with the grandkids, so we're really happy about that for a while. I did my education in New England for college, and I did seminary on the West Coast and graduate school on the East Coast with some years in Germany and France to do work on languages. I've done quite a bit of travel in Turkey to take students to Bible lands, really enjoy the country of Turkey, been to Israel once. So I love making the Bible real for students, that it's not just a disembodied bunch of stories, but it's landed and real people walking real roads, getting real sandals dusty and all of that. I think it's important to understanding the text. So mostly I teach Bible classes and early Christianity, dabble quite a bit among the Puritans just as a hobbyist.
Hey there, listener. I wanted to take a quick moment to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and our mission here at ISI is educating for liberty. If you'd like to join us in fulfilling our mission, consider helping us by rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, to help us reach more listeners like yourself. Now, back to the show. Excellent. That sounds like a very wide background and set of experiences. I'd love to hear more specifically about what you were just saying at the end there about making the Bible real, rooted. How do you do that? And how does that differentiate from how maybe some other people are teaching the Bible to students and to theologians today?
Yeah, the Bible happened with real people in real time, right. And Christianity puts itself out there as a historical faith. Paul's going to say, if you could show me the bones of Jesus in a bag, I'd have to stop being a Christian, because if Jesus is not bodily raised in history, we're of all people most to be pitied. So it's real, it's historical, real people did this, and it's really easy for us as Christians in the 21st century to think of all these people as stories that we heard about as kids and disembodied things, people walking around with halos and hovering 6 inches off the ground. And to actually see the place where Paul might have stood and preached a sermon, to actually see the Jordan River where John the Baptist might have baptized somebody, just makes the Bible stories, I think, come back alive as real things. And to understand that the resurrection is a historical event, right, and not just a dogma that we talk about. There's a kind of docetism. That's what the ancient fathers called the heresy of thinking about Jesus himself as only seeming to be human and actually being God, and the humanity of him doesn't matter. And the church was quite adamant that the humanity of Jesus matters, and the bodily form in which we find ourselves as created beings really matters.
Right. So I'm familiar with the work of Bart Ehrman, who I think gets sort of pride of place in the modern theological studies discipline. And I know he argues, I think unconvincingly and, you know, not on the merits of the actual historical fact, that all of the Gospels, for instance, are anonymous and there was no attribution. Like, he tries to sever the historical lineage of the works that tell us about who Jesus Christ is, his life, this sort of historical things that you're talking about. I'm sure at Hillsdale, this is not, he does not have pride of place, but how do you interact in, I guess, theological circles outside of Hillsdale that are dabbling in or sort of been captured by his work? And how do you even begin to sort of disentangle those things and those problems?
Right. Well, Bart Ehrman is a, you know, good academic scholar. He's done a lot of good work that's worth reading, but the applications he makes of it sometimes, I think, are as subject to criticism as he wants to subject other things to criticism. So we need to be fair with our criticisms. And I would say that there is plenty of evidence for the historical resurrection. There is plenty of evidence that there were historical writers of the Gospels. Now, it's true, as he says, that they are written without attribution at their time. We know who wrote them because of second century writers like Papias and later Irenaeus, who tell us this is who wrote the Gospel. And so we might debate about who the actual authors were, but they were followers of Jesus in Jesus' own time, who were eyewitnesses of Jesus. And many of the attributions have good historical evidence behind them. So I'm willing to let them be anonymous and speak for themselves without bringing in extraneous presumptions about, I know that Luke was a doctor, so this must be a allusion to something that a physician might refer to. But we don't have to do that to really get the benefit of what the gospel writers are saying. Paul is not anonymous, so we've got some elements of the New Testament that don't fit that category of anonymity. We know who Paul was, we know where he lived, we know quite a bit about the life of Paul.
Gotcha. And I mean, for context, you'll be speaking at our honors conference this summer, so I'll be excited when we get to meet in person and, you know, spend a week together at ISI's headquarters. And for students who have been accepted into the conference, this can be sort of a primer for what Professor Westblade is going to speak about. And then for others who didn't get in, this is kind of a view or a look under the hood. But I know you're focusing, I think, for us on the first or the second chapter of Russell Kirk's work, which focuses on the place and the importance of Israel for America and our own self-understanding. So maybe from a bird's eye view, you could start to orient us towards that sort of view of things.
Yeah, it's so important that that chapter on Jerusalem is in a book with chapters about Athens and Rome and other cities that are at the roots of our American order. And I'm glad he even started with Jerusalem, because in many ways it's probably more important than the Greco-Roman background for the Christian elements of our American order. And they're often neglected because we have lots of classical education, and Jerusalem often gets fed to us in catechisms and Sunday school without quite as much intellectual academic rigor behind it. But Jerusalem is crucial to bring into our discussion of the roots of America, in especially from a theological point of view. We often hear at my campus, and probably on your campus, of the importance of goodness, truth, and beauty. It's almost a mantra here on my campus. And that's Athens, and that's Jerusalem for sure. And Christianity can agree with that. But Jerusalem has some more to add to that. The Plato and Aristotle can agree that God is good and true and beautiful. And by that, they mean he is static. He just is, and he's characterized by being. And so the perspective that I think this chapter brings, or what emphasis I would like to bring from this chapter to our discussion of American order, is the character of the God of Jerusalem that is far outshines the character of the gods of Athens and Rome, who make up the classical part of our order. Goodness, truth, and beauty are great, and the Bible affirms all of that, but the Bible also says God acts and he creates, and there's so many active verbs that are connected with God's work in the world. I was listing them one time. God brings, God delivers, God sanctifies, he chooses, he delights, just all kinds of things that God does that Aristotle and Plato could never say about God, because those would involve God in change. And change is deficient, and so God can't do that. So you'll never find the word create connected to God in Aristotle, And that's the very first thing that the Bible wants to say about God. In the beginning, God creates. And that's an activity, and it's important to know about God, and only Jerusalem tells us that. And the American order depends upon an active God and not just a God characterized by static being. So one of my favorite verses is Isaiah 64:4. You've never seen a God like this, says Isaiah. I have not seen or ear ever heard of a God. And the sense in which he says God is unique is that this is a God who acts. This is a God who works. And so that activity of God is really essential to our understanding of reality, of ontology. And I really believe that what you believe about God determines everything that you think about everything else. So that's where we need to start. That's where Kirk starts his book. I think it's really important to hear him tell us that God is a just God. That implies activity on God's part. And then the other part of that verse from Isaiah that I want to go on and stress that has a lot of application to government in America is that God is a God who works for those who wait for him. God works for us. Kirk wants to say that all of the compacts, the covenants, are for humanity's benefit. That's an important thing to know because every other culture understands God as wanting us to be slaves on his plantation. We work for him, and he'll give us wages if we work hard enough and if we earn them. And this God says, you will never earn anything from me. All the earning is to God, and all the glory and the credit for that work goes to God. And so we should never try to work for God as though God had needs that he needs us as slaves to do for him. God created us to do the one thing he couldn't do in eternity, which was to show mercy to people who had needs. That's why we exist, for God to meet needs for us. And that has political applications as well as theological applications.
Maybe I'll just, as a follow-up, just ask you to delve more into the implications of that.
Yeah, so the way that God defines himself with respect to his people is by these covenants. You get a covenant with Adam and with Noah and Abraham, David, Moses, and all of those covenants. I tell my students the covenant is a DTR moment in God's relationship with us. It's the, you know, sit down with your friend. This is the time to define the relationship. The covenant defines the relationship, and it says, I'm the worker, and you are the one who's going to receive the benefit of my work. I'm the patron. You're the client. That is what a lawyer tells me. This is what a doctor tells me. We're in a relationship with God the way that we have a relationship with a doctor as a patient. So the covenants that God makes with people are doctor's prescriptions, and they're often perverted into job descriptions. Do these things, and I'll give you a nice paycheck at the end of your life. And God doesn't roll that way. God does these things and tells us what to do and what kind of laws to follow because they're for our benefit and they're the ways in which the doctor's telling us to be well and to get better. The Latin word for health is solace. We get our word salvation from that word for health. So God wants me to be healthy, and so he enters a doctor-patient, client-patient-client relation or patron-client relationship with me. And in that patron-client relationship, he does the work, and he therefore gets the credit for the work. He gets the paycheck for the work, but I get the health, the benefit of his good counsel for me. And that becomes a pattern throughout all the covenants, and the covenants of the Old Testament are the foundation for all of the covenants that people made with each other when they arrived on American shores from European origins. They agreed with one another on the pattern of biblical covenants. That means that the agreement that they made in the American order for how government ought to relate to the people is, we're going to relate to each other in such a way that our government, who's in charge of us, who is our patron, works for us. And we have done our best in America to kind of twist that all around, or at least the government wants to twist that all around, say, you work for me. Every April 15th, I'll tell you how much of what you've done you get to keep, but it's all mine, and all the work is mine, or that is all of the work that you do is for my benefit because the government's the needy one and we the people are the suppliers of the needs of the government. And that is contrary to every covenant that God made with his people. So as the covenants find their way from the Old Testament prophets to the Puritans as they begin to found colonies to the U.S. Constitution that's based upon all those state constitutions, they all say government should work for you. You don't work for the government. That, I think, is revolutionary for a generation that's growing up with kind of the wrong impression of what the American order is all about.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, especially at the end there. But that's very interesting and fascinating, I guess, way of looking at it. Because, I mean, you, going back to what you said earlier with like Plato and Aristotle, God just, he doesn't do anything himself, but he's just the cause. So with Aristotle, like the heavens and the stars revolve around him because of the beauty of his being, this unmoved mover, which is maybe.
And they're all part of him. They're just emanations of right. God because he never can create something that's not God.
Sure. And with Plato, he has the demiurge, which sort of reflects and then creates. But it's not actually God. It's this sort of other lower thing in the order of being. I actually am curious, the role of deism in the American founding is premised on this sort of vision of God. What is your perspective or your view on the role that deism plays in the founding and how that view influences or has a political theology versus this view that comes through the Puritans, comes through the various states and their religious organizations and these covenants that you're talking about. There sort of seems to me, at least in the history of, that there's a sort of a both and thing happening where there are these two different strains. How do we kind of parse those two things out or look at them when we think about us?
Yeah, it's a great inquiry that I think will stimulate a lot of thought. If you think about the problem of faith and reason, mm-hmm. which boils down to the difference between deism and theism, that problem of faith and reason has been not intractable, but a difficult problem that theologians have wrestled with. Aquinas comes up with a pretty good resolution of those. I think Jonathan Edwards does. So at various points in time, people have found a good way to bring reason and faith together to work harmoniously with each other and not at odds with each other. You got Tertullian who says Athens and Jerusalem, they don't have anything to do with each other. And I am more inclined to say, they have a lot to do with each other, but they sort of operate on parallel tracks. So the theist wants to say God is involved in the world and he's doing everything. And so he is basically, even at the muscular, corpuscular level, he's saying to every little corpuscle in our bloodstream, flow, little corpuscle, flow all the time. He's actively involved. The deist says he wound it up and set it on the shelf, and the miracle is that it runs by itself because God was so wise in setting it up that way. There probably were a lot of deists among our founders, and that's true, but the important thing is that they had a view of God. And deism doesn't necessarily contradict the idea that God's working for me. It's a question of how he's doing that work for me. And the deist is more open to backgrounds in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment that say our reason can figure a lot of stuff out. God's laid all the pieces out. Now we know how to manipulate the pieces. I'm much more comfortable myself with a theistic perspective in which God is actively motivating me to pick up the pieces and put them together and make sense out of the puzzle. The deist kind of wants to confine all that to my reason, and I don't need revelation. All that revelation happened at the beginning. We don't need it anymore. I think that's a foreshortened understanding of how God operates, but it doesn't necessarily upset the apple cart of how the American order might have gotten resolved in the beginning. So I'm happy for the deist that they weren't atheists. They really believed there was a God and that they could trust that God. They just didn't believe that God was involved in them very much. And I think that's a sad thing that they can't have a relationship and an understanding of an active God at that time. But deism and theism are perspectives on God that I think can both be affirmed in the truths that deism at least partially has, in the same way that you can put the humanity of Christ and the deity of Christ on parallel tracks and affirm them all at the same time. Mm. So, as intractable a problem as that is, and we have that problem in the sciences and the humanities. I don't really want God interfering in my laboratory work in the science lab. I don't want one of those nasty Christians on the other side of the room praying my experiment will turn out differently this time. I want it to go according to rules that are kind of baked into the system like a deist wants. So in some ways, science has to operate in a kind of methodological deism, whereas in the humanities, we're really happy about a theistic God who answers our prayers, who does something in Aunt Mary's life in the hospital room that makes the doctor come out and say, can't explain this, but she's going to get better. And we go, yay, hallelujah, God is still active. I think both the sciences and the humanities and their desires to understand God in certain ways can both be true in the same way that faith and reason can be true on parallel tracks with each other, because we're made in the image of Christ. And Christ is at the same time fully God and fully human. Therefore, I can be fully scientific and fully in the humanities and take classes in both of those kinds of divisions of the curriculum at the same time without my head blowing up. And it really is kind of underneath the same problem of the predestination and free will. God is sovereign and I have responsibility. How do we put those two things together? We're made in the image of Christ. And that genius of Christianity to say both and rather than either or is really crucial to our understanding of God, which, of course, in turn is important to our understanding of order in government.
Mm, absolutely. I want to go back to the Puritans. We've talked about the Puritans on this podcast before, sort of from the more historical angle, but tying it in with Kirk, how he sort of uses the Puritans to give us a better sense of what you described earlier as the covenant, and the idea of a social covenant and a political order of this early settler period, and what that tells us sort of reflecting backwards from our own Christian standpoint back into sort of understanding Jerusalem that way.
Yeah, I think the Puritans were heavily dependent upon their scriptures. You talk about the Puritans, do you prick them? They bleed scripture. That's what they used to say. So the Puritans, when they're trying to do government, go back to the Bible as their model, as their foundation for that. I think Kirk sort of overstates things. At one point, he says that it's no wonder the Puritans failed to establish a latter-day biblical state. In some ways, I think they actually did succeed in establishing a biblical state, because the Bible's covenants are the foundation of their colonial covenants, which become the foundation of the U.S. Constitution. So I think the Puritans were going back to a kind of model of covenants, which the early church picked up in terms of leadership and government within the polity of the church as a plurality of elders who run the church. That's what Calvin was picking up on in the time of the Reformation, to create a kind of representative form of government. The cantons of Switzerland are still sort of organized the way Calvin's Geneva was organized, with representative elders who, on behalf of the people, are providing the wisdom for government, but see themselves as working for the benefit of the people and not expecting the people to be working for them. So Calvin's going back to the covenants of the Old Testament. The Puritans are going back to Calvin to get back to the covenants of the Old Testament. And that's where the American order got rooted in the very beginning, was in a biblical model of how God runs the show. And it may happen through theocracy. It may happen through democracy. There's lots of ways. I think that's the point that Kirk is trying to make, is that there's no one set of government that is ideal or mandated, but there is a kind of model of government in those covenants that I think the Puritans picked up on and has been part of the great success that we've had in America. We're starting to dwindle, lose some of that now with other visions of what America might be, But I think that they were onto something by getting back to those prophets of the Old Testament.
I remember there was a student at one of our prior honors conferences. He's Orthodox Jewish, so and he critiqued this chapter of Kirk as relying too much on Protestant Christianity, as in it wasn't really an authentic Judaism. So to say Jerusalem is very important for the American project and American civilization, but then, you know, mostly doing most of the work through Puritan or, you know, Protestant Christian theology and political philosophy, that's not really a genuine Judaism and or not really representing Jerusalem correctly. I'd be curious to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, I'd love to have a conversation with that student because I think I'd probably learn something from him. But I do see Israel as crucial to this whole picture because Abraham was given as the father of the nation of Israel a mandate at the very beginning of his call to be a light to the nations. So America ought to continue to look at Israel and learn from the model of Israel what God's revelation is all about. That's why Israel was a chosen people. They weren't necessarily chosen for salvation. They were chosen to model biblical revelation. So I think the place where I would cavil with the student is to say that the model that Calvin's going back to from the Reformation, that the Puritans are going back to from the early American colonies, is a Jewish model of how to do house churches. They were all Jews in the first century who began the church, and they met in houses. They met on the organization of families. And where did they get all of that? From the organization of the synagogue that the Jews created during the exile. So the reason why in the church we call people father and brother and sister is because the synagogue was a family and the house church was a family built upon the synagogue model. So it really is a kind of Jewish pattern, and these are Jewish covenants to which the Puritans thought they were returning. So whether they're Protestant or Catholic or Eastern Orthodox or whatever they are, Judaism is the foundation that we're going back to try to determine what worked the best when God was close to the people.
We've got a professor that we do a lot of work with who says, if you're Christian, then you're at least Jewish. And he was a Jewish convert to Christianity.
Right. Yeah, right.
Another sort of interesting theme that I find in Kirk is that, especially in Roots of the American Order, a lot of different work is being done. America, to build America, or for America to emerge out of Western civilization and to happen, it's through this long set of traditions that are developed over time. They change according to circumstance. And there's various different threads that run together between, you know, Jerusalem, Athens, and Rome, and London, to getting to Philadelphia. I'd be curious to hear a bit more about not only we've already spoken a fair bit about how those various cities work together and tend to work together. That is how you get an American project. But considering that we talk a lot about there are various themes of tension potentially in the American project, how those things actually reflect backwards. Give me thoughts on that.
Give me some idea what tensions you're thinking about when you say that.
I guess how about for one thing, America, I think, is constitutionally, when you think about separation of powers, checks and balances, but also the different institutions, both federal, within and across the federal government, and also between the federal government and the state governments. You have, and I'm not endorsing this view of Wilson, but he's talking about how a machine or an organism set against itself cannot long exist. But you have these various different regime types that are supposed to cohere together to form a polity that both at once preserves liberty, ensures the common good, and tries to get the best people in power so that they can rule and rule on behalf of the people as their representatives for their common good and according to their interests. But I guess there are various tensions or even, designed fracture points or points of clash. And then there's maybe different themes of like liberty and equality, perhaps, or liberty and tradition or order, rights and duties, which, I mean, any ISI student would know that those things go together and are sort of flip coins of each other. But I think there's various room for various potential, at least, tensions. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on any.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I have the right answer for all of those, but I do think there are answers that can be gleaned from better and better understanding of the prophets and the apostles and their perspectives on these things. Kirk points out that one of the values in American order is that there are checks on the civil authority. We don't allow and abide tyrants very well, and it's easy for tyrants to arise when there are no checks in place. As Lord Acton from London wants to remind us, power does corrupt, and the more absolute it gets, the more absolutely it's going to corrupt us. So there are the tensions that you refer to are might actually be benefits to the American order, that there are not free reins to tyrants to take off and run in their own direction. When one group of party starts to run in a certain direction, there's going to be another party that has an opportunity to rise up and say, not so fast. So when the federal government gets too much power and the states aren't able to operate again, we're seeing some examples of that in Texas these days. Right. It's good that the states can say, wait a minute, federal government, you're overstepping your bounds. Sometimes it's good for the federal government to step in and tell a state you're overstepping your bounds. And those checks and balances are part of what I think maintains the order, because it gives more voices an opportunity to weigh in on their perspectives on the truth that they're pulling out of whatever authorities they're consulting, hopefully prophets and apostles, but lots of other competing authorities on the line these days. But I'm glad for those tensions to be there. I'm glad that there are multiple parties. I hate for the uniparty that seems to be developing to have too much free course given to it to set up the government in a way that I have to work for it. So, yeah, federalism is, I think, a pretty healthy system. Democracy is a pretty good system for, you know, it's, as somebody once said, it's the worst of all systems except for all the rest of them. It's a good way to keep checks and balances on otherwise tyrannical impulses in the order.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to sort of disparage the American project or say that these checks and balances aren't good, but I do know that there are sort of some currents of thought today that are looking at some of the built-in designed tensions with a more negative or critical view. And I mean, that is the progressive view of government too.
And there are negatives about them, especially if you're on the side that's being criticized.
Sure.
But that's part of the game that we play, and we make a contract with each other to listen to each other and to be checked, be willing to be checked in that process, to buy for myself the opportunity to check somebody else. The one thing about the American founding that gives me some pause is that we emphasize rights so much. The Bill of Rights has sort of encoded in our order an idea of rights and therefore an ideal of litigation to get my way. And the more that happens, the more I want to take people back to Paul, 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, and his willingness to give up rights for the benefit of somebody else. So honestly, I wish that we had a bill of responsibilities instead of a bill of rights. If we could turn those 10 things that are very valuable to us away from my right to leverage you to an expectation that I should help you, I think we'd have a healthier society. So that I think rights and the litigious society that they've created is an unhealthy development in the American order. I love my rights, but I think that people can manipulate rights, and that we're seeing that all the time.
Definitely, absolutely true. And I mean, at the time, the Bill of Rights was, of course, very contentious, even amongst the founders, debating over whether we needed one or, and
right.
All of the state constitutions and bills of rights even also talked about duties, but those aren't mentioned in the federal one. So yeah, no, I think especially contemporaneously, as we've forgotten the connection between rights and duties that Kirk wanted to emphasize so much as something that was needful to remember and then to practice for a properly ordered society, political community, that would certainly be something, a good priority, rhetorically, maybe even politically, to reemphasize or reintroduce those various duties. I want to ask one more question since we're starting to come to the end of our time, and it's sort of keeping us in contemporary circumstances. I think this view that we've been talking about the role of the Puritans, about the role of Israel, theism and deism, these are, you know, thoroughly religious views and perspectives that have played a foundational role in what America is and what America was. And we've sort of intimated in some respects how this is now being lost. Aaron Wren calls it, we're living in a negative world where Christianity is spurned, where I think it's primarily Christianity, but I also think Judaism, maybe some of the things that we've been seeing in the wake of October 7th, spurned and criticized. And, you know, it's not something that is respected in the way that it was even, I don't know, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. Roger Ayer calls it post-Christian. I'm wondering, and we've talked about how as well that we now are seen as being working for the government, this sort of all-encompassing state. What's your practical, I'm sure you talk with students and faculties, other people, about how we could start to restore or move towards a new, but based on perhaps the old view of reversing this trend. Do you have any, I guess, was it prophylaxis or something of that sort?
Well, the thing that I've been increasingly emphasizing in my courses recently, because of the kind of developments that you're talking about, is a focus on authority. I think that that's the crisis that our younger generation now is facing. We've lost a sense of authority. There's no pole star to guide us. There's no bedrock to get an anchor into. And because we're basically adrift and sort of feeling like we have to come to terms with that as the truth of things, that there is no authority, the only authority left is myself. Mm-hmm. I make my own decisions and I define my own identity, we like to say these days. And so we've begun to see reality as socially constructed, that is made up. And we can get certainty out of that because as we make it up, we'll all agree within our own little circle that this is going to be this way and your circle can have it that way. And there's no way to adjudicate the difference between them. But as long as I'm in my little circle, I've got certainty and happy agreement from my peers. But there's a crisis when one looks underneath the platform that you've just constructed and realize it's not standing on anything. And I read a really insightful article a number of years ago in the Chronicle of Higher Education by a man out at University of Virginia who pointed out the speed with which this generation lives. The music beat is fast. The cell phones connect us immediately to things. The internet connects us immediately to things. We're on the telephone at one party, finding out what's going on at the next party because we're always on the move. And he suggested that the reason for that speed and that restlessness of this culture is, to quote Emerson, when the ice is thin, safety depends upon skating fast. And I think that our generation is skating as fast as they can because they're afraid that the ice is very thin, that there is no foundation there. So if we're going to give some security back to our American culture and order, we got to reestablish a connection to something authoritative, something that has evidence for its authority. And I think Christianity, along with Judaism, has the best means to provide that for people. It has the most sensible answers. It has the most historical evidence going for it. And so, in a way, the answer to your question is we need to preach the gospel. We need to bring people back to the apostles and the prophets. We need to help our generation understand the tradition that they're standing in and the evidence that that tradition had for the authorities that it rested upon, so that we can restore some confidence to people more than the thin ice of defining my own identity and defining my own value systems. So in a word, my answer to your question is, let's relocate authority.
I like that. That's a good suggestion. What you said reminds me of Pascal. I think it's in the Pensées, where he says the crisis of modern man is that he can't even sit for alone in his room for 1 hour with his thoughts. And, I'm a conservative guy. I'm a Christian, but I find that to be true, and I'm always trying to go. So I think something for all of us to take away from that is to slow down and focus on the foundational things, the most important things, which are actually very basic. Well, Professor Westblade, thank you very much. This has been a great conversation and a great preview for more things to come at the Honors Conference, and I look forward to meeting you. If people want to follow more of your work, maybe they're not going to the Honors Conference, but where can they find your work? What are some things that you'd recommend to them?
Well, I've written some on Pauline morality, especially the question of free will and predestination. Some of my work is in a book called, it came out a couple of times. It's called Still Sovereign, a book that Tom Schreiner and Bruce Ware put together. So some essays on Paul. I've actually written most recently on Islam. I'm teaching a seminar on Islam, and having traveled in Turkey, I've tried to become a student of Islam. So I've written about it and about the benefits that Christianity has to offer to Islam in a better understanding of atonement and getting the majesty of God put together with the gravity of sin in the way that Christianity, I think, does better than Islam. I'm working on a book on the Gospels right now, so I don't know when that'll be done, but that's the next thing, that's the project that I'm working on right now.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Professor.
It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to being out there to meeting you in person. Johnny Burke is an old friend of mine from his student days here, so I'm looking forward to seeing him and Amanda again. So it's going to be a great summer.
Excellent. It absolutely is.
Thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out our website at isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, select Modern Age articles, debates, lectures, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.